Mother, man.
This is Catherine Ramsland, and you're listening to Murder Metal Mayhem.
Spreading faster than a case of the clap in a trailer court. Able to shatter eardrums within a 666-mile radius. A podcast more brutal than all the rest. It's Murder Metal I have the privilege to be interviewing a very accomplished author and professor of forensic psychology, Dr. Catherine Ramsland. It's hard to watch a true crime documentary and not see you on there, Dr. Ramsland. You really get your name out there. It's pretty amazing. And now that I've seen you on there, I seem like I see you every single one. So thank you for taking the time to talk to us on Murder Metal Mayhem.
Well, I'm happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
Excellent. Excellent. Now, you have a very impressive resume of books that you've written. I'm an author. I've only written three. I feel like a hack artist to see how many you've written, and impressive as well. I've got a few in my own collection. Can you tell us how long you've been writing and how prolific you've actually been?
I've been writing since, I think, about 1988 was the very first book. And so that gives me 31 years, something like that. And then I've actually lost count because one came out 2 days ago and then I just handed another one in and I'm working on another one. So I think I'm around 67-ish and over 1,000 articles and reviews and 400 plus blogs over the past 7.5 years. So yeah, I do a lot of writing.
I guess. Is there a certain time of the day you prefer to write, in the morning or night, or does it matter?
It's kind of sporadic. I like to start right away in the morning for whatever, because I'm also a professor and an assistant provost at my university. So I don't get much time in the morning, but I do like to start that way. And then I'll do it whenever I have a moment. And then a lot of times I will work in the evening until about 9:30.
Okay. I always like to hear what other writers do as habit, because to me it's the habit, it's the the schedule of it that seems to keep me on task. I can't just kind of randomly do it.
No, I agree. I think, and I've actually written about that in terms of how to set yourself up for the best creative kinds of sparks of aha moments and how to keep yourself very prolific is really to have that routine and to fight for it, saying no to a lot of other things and staying with your routine. It sends a message to your body. There's something called body memories, and your body gets to expecting that certain routine. And when you don't sit down with your coffee in the morning, you feel like, something's wrong here. So it's about training your body to want to get to the keyboard and write and do, or if you write by hand or whatever, it's training your body to know what to expect and to push you toward it eventually.
Yeah, that definitely makes sense to me. Now, what got you interested in forensic psychology? Because that's a very, unique, I would think, field, maybe more so for a female. I'm not sure. But what got you interested in that?
Well, it was actually very whimsical.
sound very whimsical to me.
It really was. I was teaching philosophy at Rutgers University. That was my first career. I had been a therapist and did not like clinical work at all. And I decided to just find another interesting degree. Graduate degree, and there I was in New Jersey at the time, and there was one at John Jay College of Criminal Justice, a master's in forensic psychology. At the time, I was doing a bit of writing for the Court TV website. It was called Crime Library, and I thought, oh, that one might be a good degree to have to enhance my writing. And I had no expectation it would change my life, my career, and really everything.
Wow.
It just pushed me in a whole new direction that I never expected. I did not expect to be a full-time professor of forensic psychology at all. And now I'm a consultant for death investigators. I do police trainings and attorney trainings. It was never even on my radar. It was honestly a whim. Oh, look, I could go to school at John Jay.
Sure.
I have the money. I have the opportunity. I think I'll do this. And wow, it really opened things up. And I will say, by the way, I'm also doing that right now with an MFA, a Master of Fine Arts degree.
Oh, wow.
This opportunity opened up last January for me to get that, and I jumped on it. And we did our residency in Ireland, and we're doing another in Scotland. And for me, as a writer, regardless of any of the forensics, as a writer, it's an opportunity to continue not only to keep myself open to new ideas and whatnot, but I'm learning from two incredible mentors to make my writing better and even different in a more poetic sense. And I'm so happy that I jumped into that one. And again,
yeah,
I just there it was. Why shouldn't I do it?
That's amazing. Now stay away from those Sawney Bean caves over there in Scotland. Now, please. Yes, we need another 60.
You better stay away from me.
Yeah, really. We need another 67 books from you. So please. Now, it's amazing how popular true crime has gotten right now. I had this conversation just recently with John Borowski because he's obviously in this field as well. And we've seen it with our podcast just kind of blew up very quickly. What do you attribute that to? Is it social media? Is it a kind of a thirst for the violent? Or what is it about true crime that seems to really have taken hold as of recent?
Yeah, it is interesting because I started writing when true crime was considered the ghetto of writing.
It was
just, the bottom of the barrel. You're never going to make any money if you do that. That was, all the word I got from publishers. But we sort of really got set up by something like the O.J. Simpson trial when that was aired on Court TV for all day long, and it became a social event. Everybody was watching it. There were characters. Those characters had breakout profiles,
Right.
And then everybody was wondering what's going to happen. So in my opinion, a lot of the true crime networks, which devote themselves entirely to true crime, have set up shows so that they're like little murder mysteries. And I think it isn't the violence that people, now of course there is a whole segment of people who love violence, but they're a minority of this audience. The audience is really all about solving mysteries, the
right.
mental challenge of that, trying to understand why people would do what they do. The serial killers are popular, but that's not the most popular. The most popular are more the domestic crimes, the things that are
for
your ordinary neighbors. And people are so very curious about the kinds of things that can happen right next door. And I think that's really part of it is we're opening up whole segments of who we are as human beings that typically would have, been in the newspaper for a couple of days. But these cases get played out over and over. I just did something for a production company on the Lizzie Borden case. That's from 1892.
Right.
But people love the whole mystery and mystique and mm-hmm. who done it. I think that's really more what's powering all this than any kind of thirst for gore.
Okay.
But also you have the scripted TV shows on top of the true crime. You have the scripted TV shows like Criminal Minds and all the CSI franchises, Law and Order, keeps going with the Special Victims Unit. You have all of those, and that also kind of sets people up to have certain expectations. So by the end of a show, whatever it is, whether true crime or scripted fiction, there's a sense of resolution of the world is back in its rightful place. Everything is okay. We identify the bad guy or girl and it's all taken care of. And I think there's that sense of resolution in most true crime stories that people like. I mean, you really don't see networks taking on too many of the totally unsolved crimes.
True,
you know,
true.
Unless it's something like the Zodiac or Jack the Ripper.
Or Black Dahlia.
Or Lizzie Borden even. You don't typically see a show devoted simply to here's a case, but we don't know what's going to happen.
Right, right.
You know, it's always
not
about...
Not satisfying.
It's always about the satisfaction of it. So true. I think true crime has really been able to meet that narrative in a way that only fiction could do before. So that to me is a lot of what drives it.
Very, very interesting. Now, I really enjoyed your book, BTK, Confession of a Serial Killer. His case was very fascinating to me, especially how he eluded the police for so long. But, of course, his hubris got the best of him years later. And how your involvement began with him was with correspondence. Is that correct?
Well, actually, that, too, was a very strange... Most of my life has been very weird in terms of...
You're not going to use the word whimsical to describe BTK.
Well, not whimsical, but it was certainly serendipitous terms of how it occurred. It wasn't something I sought out. What happened was when he was captured in 2005, a woman stepped forward, and she doesn't like to be named, so I'm not going to name her. We had a nickname for her. I think we called her True Grit or something like that, or Dawnette. And then I was Twilight, you know, because he loves everything's coded. So she had wanted to write a book about him. She had never written a book, but she thought she could do it. And she took up this correspondence with him that lasted about 5 years. She was in the newspaper as, you know, undertaking this project. And I saw her on Facebook one day. She didn't know me, but I just said, "Whatever happened to your BTK book?" Well, she didn't know who I was because she had one of my books she was going to use as a model.
Oh.
She begged me to take it over, where they had a fund, a sort of organized, where whatever this happened with this book, they would get most of the proceeds. So I had to sign into that and say that was okay with me, and it was. The second thing was they had to also evaluate me and what I wanted to do. So I basically wrote a proposal for them discussing the fact that I didn't want to just interview and work with Dennis Rader on his so-called autobiography. I created something I called a guided autobiography. No one else has done something like that. There's no genre for it. But I created a guided autobiography so that whatever he had to say was going to end up benefiting criminal justice, forensic psychology, and law enforcement. And they liked that. Apparently, they had turned down a few other writers who are largely tabloid-oriented writers. And they said, if there's, you know, we don't want there to be a book at all about him, but if there's going to be one in which he participates, then that's the kind of book we would want. So I passed that test. I mean, all of this took about
a
year.
That's amazing.
And during that time, I also then had to win him over. So there were three strands going on here.
Yeah.
To win him over, and this is the whole first chapter of the book, I had to agree to work with his code system.
Yes.
And so he sent me this weird.
That was crazy.
I know. And then sent half of it to the, you know, very kind of Zodiac stuff.
Yes.
Sent the other half to, you know, True Grit. And then we had to compare together what all of this meant, because then what he would do is he had this app like A, B, C, D, and each of those was a symbol for. Then he had a symbolic word, and that word would be found somewhere in his letters.
Wow.
It was so complicated, but kind of intriguing, challenging.
Big time. Yes.
And I was up for it. But then he kept forgetting what things meant. So by the end of chapter one, you see me creating the code, which
right.
is interesting because one of his big issues is he doesn't want women controlling things.
Right.
And here I was taking control of the whole process.
That's
but at
hilarious.
Any rate, by the end of all that, and I'd met the attorney for the victim's families, I'd gone out to Wichita, I'd met Dennis, you know, in the prison. And so by the end of all that, you know, we were ready to go. Everything was in place. The legal papers were all signed. But then publishers didn't want to touch that. Because, even though they found the whole project very intriguing, they didn't want to get involved in a legal document involving the victim's families.
Sure.
So it became such a issue finding somebody. You know, it wasn't that they didn't think it was a great idea. It's just that they didn't want to
deal with the aftermath.
Also, some of my prior editors said, this is too dark. I don't want to read a book that's from his mind.
Yeah.
Which I thought was interesting.
It is very dark. I mean,
it is very dark, but isn't that what everyone's
Well, of course. I mean, what do you expect?
So why would publishers pull back from that? That was weird to me.
Now,
but anyway, so finally found a home for it, and you know, we proceeded to do this together.
Very, very interesting. Now, what I found interesting as well was this intricate log that he kept that you talk about in the book of every minute detail of his activities in prison. Can you expand upon that? I mean, what was the deal with that?
Yeah, that was one of the very first things he sent me was these pages filled with, you know, what time he got up, what breakfast he had, and what time, and when he was finished, and what he did next, and which TV shows he was watching, and, you know, how much time he devoted to correspondence to the many people who were writing to him. And it was just this log. That's exactly what it was, a log of his activities, because he believed this would be of interest to somebody.
Okay.
I pretty much set him straight that is not what to be putting in. I don't really care about
that he ate peas and carrots every day or some really obscure information.
Well, occasionally, and he's not the only serial killer I had correspondence with. Occasionally, it's interesting if, like, a holiday is coming up, what do they do?
Right.
What is that for them? So you do get some interesting information, but I really didn't need a day, minute-by-minute log of his activities. And he's got all of this in boxes. He's got all these pages and stuff.
Wow.
That he thinks somebody will want one
sure.
day.
Sure. So, well, what else does he have to do, right? I mean, he might as well fill his time doing something, I guess.
But you wouldn't believe how busy he is.
Wow.
And sometimes 2 weeks will go by and I haven't heard from him. Well, he's just so busy.
Wow. That's crazy.
He's really busy. So he watches, certain programs. He has correspondence, although he's telling me now he's going to kind of close down on that. By the end of the year, he's feeling, at this point, he's feeling a bit tired. He's approaching 75.
Oh, wow.
He's
so you still talk
tired.
To him then?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Oh, wow.
It's been 9 years now, actually.
Oh, wow. Now, what I found interesting also, you talk about how BTK doesn't fit into that stereotypical notion of what some might think of a serial killer. And I know the McDonald triad has been, denounced for the most part in modern times. But what do you find about his background that made him into the monster that we know? Because he doesn't have the abusive childhood or I don't think he had any of the head injury stuff. I mean, what is it about him?
Well,
that
he did
makes
have,
it?
Yes, he actually had head injuries.
Oh, he did. Okay.
Which I documented. Yeah.
Okay.
But I don't know
that.
that they rise to the level of the kinds of head injuries like Richard Specks or somebody like that.
Right.
Had.
Right.
But we don't know because we didn't get to do it. We wanted to do an MRI and a functional magnetic resonance imaging scan, but we're, the warden said no. And then we tried through the governor and didn't get any response either. So unfortunately, we can't see if there was some kind of brain damage until perhaps after he dies. At any rate, first of all, thank you for saying the McDonald triad has been debunked. I say that in all of my classes and beg students to please stop thinking there's this triad of
predictors.
It's from
the 60s. So.
It was never stated that way. The guy who invented it, McDonald, the doctor, first of all, didn't even have a scientific representative group to test it on. He mused over, might there be some predictors? He had more than just those three, by the way. And then later when the FBI did their prison study, they didn't find the majority of their offenders. And their study wasn't scientific either. It wasn't representative. And it was a very tiny sample compared to how many serial killers there actually are. But they didn't find that the majority had these three signals either. And yet many of them went out with their books saying this is the McDonald triad is a right. thing. It's not. And so thank you for saying that. I've actually had people say to me with Raiders, oh, since you didn't find these things, you just didn't get the truth. I'm like, or you don't have the truth. And right. you have to drop this idea before you even get the data, that this idea of what must be true is a very poor approach. It's making the facts fit the theory rather than finding out your theory might be deficient. So Rader becomes a contributory kind of case in terms of being an outlier for that. But I think we actually do see others similar to him. And I think you're going to find the Golden State serial killer is very similar to him terms of all of his background and the kinds of things he decided he wanted to do. But you can really reform your what your goals are and what your ultimate identity would be by simply obsessing enough over something, exposing yourself enough to it. I mean, when he was in his teens, he had a number of things. One was a head injury, but also his mother dropped him on his head when he was a child and did not get help. He turned blue. He did a lot of things during before his adolescence where he would tie a rope around his waist to get erotic pleasure, and then he'd black out. So there were hypoxic events in his background. And also, he stumbled upon some true detective magazines.
Yeah, that's a common one.
It's a common one. And, I mean, you'll find this from one killer to another. There are many of them that talk about that.
Bundy.
Even though it's dismissed as being causal, we can't dismiss it as being a factor in what they... if they say this is this and had my first orgasm, that's a big deal because that means they're set up to find that very arousing and to go back to it over and over and over again. The more they expose themselves to that kind of perspective in terms of who they are, the more they're going to find ways to narrow their life focus to be that. So Rader had a number of factors, psychological factors that braided together. One of which was that females humiliated him. His mother humiliated him. His teachers humiliated him. And he got extremely upset that they had control over his life. He wanted to keep control over them. So by the time he was a teenager, he was drawing girl traps and imagining tying them to railroad tracks and, keeping someone like Annette Funicello in a cage for his pleasure. So he was already thinking what he really wanted to do was keep women under control. So that's one factor. Another factor is he wanted to be significant. He wanted to be famous. And he would see things like the Clutter Murders, which became Truman Capote's book in Cold Blood. That happened in Kansas, about 200 miles to the west of him. He was in a car with a girl he had a crush on at the time that came over the radio, and that had a big impact on him. He studied other serial killer cases like H.H. Holmes and Harvey Glattman. Anyone who bound their victims was of interest to him, and anyone who strangled their victims was of interest to him because he was learning techniques from them. So when you have somebody who is narrowing the spotlight of his sense of identity of his life to a specific type of way to become famous that will also achieve, power over women, you have a setup here for somebody whose fantasy life is going, and especially someone with an active fantasy life, is going to be looking for opportunities. And it isn't that he immediately succeeded. He tried to abduct a young woman and she fought him off. So that was a failure. He began entering houses as tryouts. Same with the Golden State Killer, actually.
Right.
If he's the ransacker,
right.
he broke into lots of homes just to steal items. And that's what Rader would do. He'd break in just so he'd feel this power over other people. And he'd take something insignificant like a hammer or, something, nothing, just to show I was in here and I had power over you. He wasn't in it to enrich himself. he was in it to be able to do it. So he had a lot of rehearsal in those kinds of things. He was a voyeur, you know, he'd run around backyards looking in windows. So he built himself up to finally deciding he's going to be a killer. And then he has some precipitating incidents. He gets laid off from a job he really, really wanted. He's angry. He's going to be taking criminal justice classes. His wife is now supporting him, which once more, under the thumb of a woman.
Right.
This is not okay with him. So that really, all of those factors together combine to be, you know, with his fantasy life, become the launching pad for, I'm going to try this.
Right.
I'm going to see if I can do it. And you don't need to have childhood abuse or head injury or anything like that to form yourself into the type of person who's decided, this is what I want to be. And
right.
It's rare. He is an outlier, but he's not the only one that we can look at and say this kind of developmental process does have traction in terms of making someone into a serial killer.
Yeah, I find that very, very interesting, and especially his study of H.H. Holmes, which I remember going back to John Borowski and his documentary about Holmes, how John was actually contacted by the FBI when they were mm-hmm. trying to find who BTK was, thinking that maybe he would show up at a premiere of the documentary
right.
down there. That was very interesting. Now, do you think he was also inspired by Zodiac and Jack the Ripper, who also liked to taunt the police and media with their letters, because that was, of course, a big thing with Dennis Rader as well?
Well, we don't know that Jack the Ripper wrote a single letter. We have no proof whatsoever that Jack the Ripper wrote any letters. So I never say that he or she or they is the author of any of those letters. And I think what Rader was inspired by with the Ripper case is that he got away with it. This is
right.
this is someone who really pulled it off. If all the victims are actually related to Jack the Ripper, we don't even know that. So
it's true. That's true.
Know, if you really look at this case, and I've been over to Whitechapel a few times, and I just reviewed a book that had 333 suspects for Jack the Ripper. I mean,
wow.
And given that, we don't even know if it's a single person, if the police are right that the canonical five was, you know, but this isn't a Jack the Ripper program, so let me put that one aside. Zodiac is more interesting because Rader says he really he was overseas at the time the Zodiac case was happening, and I know there are people who think he is the Zodiac killer because
right.
he had access to planes since he was in the Air Force. Well, you don't just get to get on a plane and go to San Francisco
right.
to California, kill, and then go back to your post. That doesn't work.
Right.
He will say that he wasn't really paying attention to Zodiac, but I think it's pretty clear he definitely read the books because many of he was a copycat in so many ways. Rader. For all that he did, was not original. He copied mostly true crime books or even fiction. He read serial killer fiction as well. He copied others. And so he doesn't say that he copied Zodiac, because I think his copycatting is pretty close, and he doesn't want to admit
right.
that, you know, he really didn't have those inspirations. But when, you know, his whole thing about being a fugitive was very
right.
Zodiac.
Yes.
The puzzles was very Zodiac. The, you know, mocking the police and whatnot. But on the other hand, his communications in 2004, when he started back up, were really distinct and not at all, aside from the one puzzle, the word puzzle, really weren't much like what the Zodiac had done.
Right.
So in a way, there, you know, he's got his own thing. But on the other hand, you know, he also copied the Crime Library story that we had posted about
right.
him.
Right.
So again, copycatting, you know, he's not an original.
Right.
He doesn't think in original ways. Honestly, he'll say it. He was a C and D student.
Sure.
He, when you read his letters, you think he must have some kind of learning disorder because his grammar and spelling are atrocious. Not when he speaks to you, that doesn't come across like that at all. But when he writes it down, it's like he has some kind of a dyslexic disorder.
Wow.
So whatever that is, I'm not sure, but it really does set him apart in many ways from the other people who have written letters to try to keep this connection. And, you know, Son of Sam was another one who did this.
Right.
He paid some attention, but he didn't care for Son of Sam because he was a shooter.
Right.
And Rader was really only interested in the stranglers. So he really paid attention to the Hillside Stranglers, for example.
Right.
You know, and he would go steal these true crime books. He never bought any. He had one of my books in his possession.
Really?
But I didn't get any royalties because he always stole what he was stealing.
Ah, there you go. I could see where he would have liked Harvey Glattman, though, especially with the photography angle.
More than anyone else, he loved Glattman. Even more than with H.H. Holmes, he was really more intrigued by the murder castle. And
right.
so his fantasy life, you know, reset that whole castle scenario in Barnes in Kansas.
Yeah.
But Glattman was really, if he had a role model, if I would name one, it would be Glattman, because Glattman bound them with rope, which was
right.
BTK's big thing.
True crime type stories.
And he read the True Detective magazine article when he was 14. He masturbated to it, had an orgasm. But the face of the terrified woman on the cover,
yep,
looking at Glattman taking the photo as he's telling her he's going to kill her, is the face Rader wanted to see of a woman absolutely under his control. That
wow.
imprinted for him as an adolescent. And every time he killed someone as the BTK killer, he was looking to have that expression.
Wow.
So that's interesting.
Yeah, big time. Now, when you met him in prison, you said, what was that like? I mean, have you met other inmates before? Anything to compare him to in that regard?
Well, I mean, other inmates I haven't met in a supermax kind
sure.
of prison. I actually got lost in the prison. And that was weird. It was a Saturday and nobody else was there. I guess other people who were visiting were already inside, but nobody was there, and they were like, okay, just walk through these doors and then go across the courtyard and take the door. And I'm like, okay, there are five doors here. Which one am I supposed to take?
That could have been bad.
Each place I was sent, there was nobody there. So I'd wander around until I could find someone. It was very weird. But with Rader, you know, you don't get to actually be in the same room. He's in one booth, you're in another, and it's through a video chat.
Oh, okay.
So it's a different experience than the kind of thing you see on TV where you're, you know,
face
you
to face.
Touch through. Yeah, I could have been face to face if he had an attorney.
Oh,
and
okay.
that attorney got me in. That's the only way I could have been face to face with him. But he didn't have an attorney. He didn't need an attorney. So the only attorney I was working with, well, I was working with the DA. She was actually a friend of mine before I ever took this project on. She wasn't too keen about me doing
it. I'm sure.
But now she's very supportive because she did see that I accomplished what I had set out to do. And the other attorney was the victim's family attorney. He actually drove me to the prison. But they wouldn't let him in, so he just drove away and left me to.
Oh, wow.
You know, I'll come back in an hour and see if you're still around. But it was a different kind of experience because he was so, you know, he's a dangerous prisoner.
Sure.
He came in with shackles around his waist, and he was shackled to the chair. But what was interesting for me was he didn't know I was coming. The first time I met him, he didn't know I was coming because it was really sort of again, whimsical. And so he's sort of grumping at the guards. And I got to watch his impression management skills. He was, you know, what do you think I am, Hannibal Lecter? And, you know, he's all this grumpy. And then he sees from the screen that I'm there. He doesn't realize I can see all this going on. So he realizes I'm there. And boy, right away. face changes. Oh, wow. Hi, how wonderful to see you. Hope you had a nice trip, et cetera. You know, just very cordial. And I will say one thing about Rader that has been different from things I've seen with other people who've interviewed. It's a small group of us who've interviewed serial killers for, you know, massive amounts of time. And often the others have been disrespectful, vulgar, demanding. They've called people in the middle of the night. They've cost them a lot of money. Rader always respected my boundaries.
That's
always
good.
And always spoke with me in a respectful manner. There was never a time when he made me uncomfortable. The only time that he broke out was when he thought I really needed to know something. And so he called me, I think it was on Tuesday or something. It was outside our typical call time. And boy, was he apologetic. You know, I'm sorry, wow. I just think that you want to know this. And, you know, so I will say that about him. He was interestingly very respectful. And it was easy to talk with him face-to-face, but much better on the phone. We did find the prison was not the greatest place to do our work because the guards would hang around my door and his door listening.
Right.
And, you know, that's not really the time to be
using
the codes and whatnot. So
sure.
We ended up doing most of it by phone. And even though I know that they're recording and they can hear anything, we did cover it with a lot of code work. One of our approaches to the codes was to watch television programs and talk through them as metaphors. So he got me watching Bates Motel, which I thought was, I'm glad he did because I was never going to watch that show. And I thought it was brilliantly done. I was very impressed with it. I got him watching The Walking Dead. We both were watching Breaking Bad. But probably the best show was this one about the Soviet spies that were planted in the United States during the Reagan years.
Oh, yeah.
The Americans. I'm going to tell you, was that ever so fruitful for metaphor, especially as the kids start figuring, the daughter starts figuring things out. She sounded very much exactly like Rader's daughter when she started giving press conferences about her betrayal and all of that when she found out her father was a serial killer. It was very interesting because he would not see those parallels. He was completely, you know, as dismissive of that being at all similar, even though the words are always exactly the same.
Right.
So that would tell me what he's blocking, what he doesn't want to know. But really, we had some amazing conversations using that show. That show and Bates Motel are probably the two best ones for us.
Very interesting. Very interesting. Now, you mentioned about finishing a new book. The book that just came out, and then you've got a new one that's going to be out. What's coming up, I should say, from you?
Well, the one I just finished, and by the way, I did write a couple of Jack the Ripper novels too.
Oh, wow. While you were in your free time.
Jack the Ripper. But hey, I got to go to Paris. I got to go to London, as part of writing. But the one I just published this week is an academic book that I co-wrote with a former FBI profiler, Mark Safrick. And that's on spree killers.
Okay.
In part, and one of the reasons we did this is Mark was instrumental in setting up the symposium in 2005 where the FBI did this international redefinition of serial killers and all that. At the time, they cut spree killers out of the nomenclature for multicide, thinking had no facility for law enforcement. Mark and I over the years had discussed that being, I thought, a mistake. Whenever I teach my class on extreme offenders, I always say they're wrong.
Right.
Spree killers belongs in there because they're not mass murderers and not serial killers. And then in Arizona in 2018, there was a case of Dwight Lehman Jones, who shot and killed a forensic psychiatrist. Then he killed two life coaches that were at the offices of a woman who had been, or I'm sorry, two paralegals who were at the offices of a woman who had been instrumental in Jones's divorce. and then a life coach at an office. Again, all of these were connected to Dwight Lehman Jones.
Wow.
His ex-wife had married her bodyguard because she was so scared of the guy. She hired a bodyguard, and she ended up marrying him, and he was an ex-cop. And he figured it out. He called the Scottsdale police and told them, this is the guy you're looking for. This is where he lives. And when they surrounded him, he killed himself. But they were able to stop him from killing anyone else that was likely on his list, such as his ex-wife and husband and his son.
Wow.
So that case, Mark and I immediately got on the phone.
Well, sure.
Said, here's the case. Here's the case. Let's see if we have any other spree killer cases that would make our argument that the FBI has to put this back in.
Right.
Because it does have practical value for law enforcement. We ended up collecting, and this became a book because we collected over 400 spree killers from 43 countries. And we categorized them. No one had ever done that before. They've categorized mass murders, they've categorized serial killers, but no one had done spree killers. So we categorized them so that we could see what percentage does have practical value for law enforcement to know about and be trained in. And that actually ended up being our largest category. So we made the case in this book, which is called Spree Killers, Practical Classifications for Law Enforcement and Criminology. We made the case that spree killers is a distinct category. It has a number of subcategories. From those subcategories, training programs could be made for law enforcement so that they can figure out how to identify and stop these people before they kill others. So I thought that was an exciting project. And then the next one is a book that's coming out in spring of how to catch a killer, or actually how to catch serial killers, and it's 30 cases of how serial killers have been caught, primarily with persistent or clever police work or forensic innovations.
Wow. Very interesting. Very interesting. Well, you're definitely a busy lady. Now, how can listeners get in touch with you and purchase your books? I know you've got stuff on Amazon, but any other way people can get a hold of you or your material?
I'm on Facebook. I have like 3 pages on Facebook. I got rid of my website some time ago because first of all, I just was too busy to keep up with it.
Yeah,
I'm pretty active on Facebook on a daily basis. There's a fans of Catherine Ramzan. There's my Catherine Ramzan page, and there's a personal page. I go on and post all kinds of stuff on that. And I also have a blog on the Psychology Today website that I've been doing for 7 and a half years. And people write to me there as well. So
okay.
It's pretty easy to find me.
Excellent. Excellent. I've seen a lot of the lovely pictures that you post on Facebook of sunsets and trees and just a lot of random things. Very interesting. It's always nice to see something like that on Facebook instead of the awful things that you usually see from people that post things they shouldn't be. So always refreshing. So thanks for taking the time out of your schedule to do this interview, Dr. Ramzan. Continued success in everything that you do. And hopefully we can talk to you again sometime in the future when something comes up and
sure.
We need somebody with your breadth of knowledge, because you definitely are that, and I really appreciate it.
Great. Well, thanks for having me. It was a pleasure to be here.
Great. Thanks. We'll see you
thanks.
Soon. Bye.
Okay. Bye.
Mother, man.